up whenever you're ready.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court, my name is Kim Crump, and I'm here on behalf of Michael Eklund, the appellant in this case. There were three issues that we raised. One was whether the trial judge's interference was so prejudicial as to deny Michael Eklund an opportunity for a fair and impartial trial. In addition, whether the government denied Mr. Eklund a fair trial by offering misleading evidence such as gang affiliation, improper rebuttal, and non-disclosed 404B evidence, as well as perjured testimony of Dyron James. Starting with the first issue, we would like to address the issue of whether or not the judge's interference denied Mr. Eklund a fair trial, and we would submit that based on the parameters set out in Cassanaugh and Parati, that there's clearly plain error found throughout the case. The court interfered by interrupting, minimizing, criticizing defense, and then reestablishing and bolstering the government's case.
Why wouldn't you object to that?
Well, we did object at one time to the court's questioning, but in a particular situation in front of a jury, it's often difficult to determine which battle you're going to fight. The battle of trying the case before the jury and not upsetting the court, or the battle of setting a record for appeal.
Well, it's almost, some of the questions the judge asked seem to have been an attempt maybe to help some dealing with it in the manner that you characterize it. And it would seem if a court seems to be predisposed to asking questions this matter, a simple thing, a courtesy to the court, or just acknowledgement would be, Your Honor, we'd like to have a moment with the court. May we approach the bench? And you would then make that out of the presence of the jury and then say, I would like to include it on the record. But apparently you just let the judge just keep asking questions and you never said anything and he just kept asking.
Well, Your Honor,
he might have thought he was helping you or, you know, kind of helped the case along.
Well, we understand that, but we certainly would note that with the analysis that we did not make the objection.
Uh-huh.
But using the plain error analysis, we would submit that we don't have to. We have to show that there's plain error that affected his substantial.
I understand the plain error aspect of it, but I'm also trying to determine to what extent would this have been an attorney strategy, or is it something that you felt like maybe some of the questions were helping, and then when it turned out that the verdict didn't come out the way you felt otherwise? Or I'm trying to assess what was going on in the trial, because if you felt that strongly, because it does look like the trial judge, he was asking a lot of questions here, and I must admit, it makes it difficult for the trial case, but most time when a trial judge does this, you at least bring it to the trial judge's attention. We like to give them a chance to correct something if they're continually doing it.
And Your Honor, we did. When it first started, it certainly didn't appear to be a problem, but as it continued, we did ask for sidebars. And if the court would—
In the record?
Yes, sir. We asked to approach the bench several times.
And you made objections?
And we made objections. We asked the court—
So you did object to the testimony?
We did, and we objected to some of the things that were happening. But we were met with resistance throughout. And in a jury trial, you certainly don't want to, in the presence of the jury, look like you're the person who is stringing a case out, especially if the judge has made negative comments. Because each time the defense says, Your Honor, may we approach the bench, then the jury is certainly going to be, oh no, here they go again. So we initially started out not making objection, but then asking the court, could we approach so that we could raise issues outside of the presence of the jury, but the court was resistant several times when we would say, Your Honor, can we approach? What now? And we noted, we mentioned in our reply brief that one of the telling examples of the court's tone was when the clerk alerted the court that counsel—
Why would you argue for plain error then? If you were making every effort to object and the court wasn't giving you the opportunity to do so, and that to object would put you in a position that it would look bad for the jury, and essentially you have what you seems like you characterize as a continuing objection, why would you argue for plain error then? Why not just error, saying you objected?
Well, Your Honor, we...
I was prevented from objecting.
We actually argued plain error because in the absence of continuously objecting, I think it's clear. I mean, you can make the argument that, yes, we made the objection, and it's not plain error, it's harmless error, but we would submit that, you know, in the broadest sense, even under plain error, I think the record is replete with examples of how the court's actions prevented Mr. Eklund from getting a fair trial. And with the case law cited in the brief, we have indicated numerous examples that there were plain error. Now the other question is whether his rights were substantially affected. And we would submit to the court that they were. He was denied a right to confront and cross-examine witnesses. He was denied his right to be presumed innocent. He was denied his right to an impartial tribunal. He was denied his right to have the jury, as opposed to the judge, determine the relevant facts. He was denied his right to proper instructions. So certainly we have numerous indications. And lastly, whether the outcome...
Excuse me, tell me where he was denied the right of cross-examination.
Your Honor, when we were trying to cross-examine several of the witnesses, one in particular, Mr. Dreon Wallace, on his interaction with Mr. Eklund as the aunt and the cousin approach, as well as what happened between him and Daquan, the individual that was there to break up the altercation or prevent him from using the gun, the court wouldn't allow it. Particularly, he said, I'm not going to allow you to cross-examine this witness. Several times, and I'm running out of time. May I complete?
Can you refer to a point of the joint appendix where that took place?
Your Honor, I'd have to go back and get
it. All right, well, why don't you sit down and you can address that on
I can certainly...
On rebuttal, you can address that on rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Watson.
May it please the court, Paul Watson for Khalid Muhammad Carter. This was a trial of a fairly simple set of facts. Occurred on March 13, 2011. There wasn't much doubt of how it started. That was an argument and a physical confrontation between Michael Eklund and Tierra Falcon, and it's no dispute about how it ended in a gunfight. And there was not a lot of dispute about several other things that happened between those two events. What was disputed is who brandished the weapon first. And it came down to a pure credibility contest between Dreon Wallace, who was just about the only prosecution witness who absolutely said that Mr. Eklund produced a gun first, and several of the defense witnesses. And in this particular type of case, it's particularly damaging when the trial court cross-examines and intensely questions the defense witnesses time and time again. The jury is looking to the trial court, trial judge, for direction in the case. The trial judge is pretty much the only person the jury believes and knows is going to direct them truthfully. Everybody else has some type of motivation, whether they be parties, witnesses, or attorneys. And in this case, the trial judge directed the jury to disbelieve the defendants and the defense witnesses. For example, in questioning Mr. Eklund, the trial court said, oh, he shot up his own car. Of course, it's hard to read into the transcript the exact tone of what was said, but would point out that that is obviously a somewhat sarcastic statement. And then that was stated an additional two times in the next few pages. And then the trial judge also went into extensive questioning and actual cross-examination of Mr. Eklund. With regard to Mr. Carter, my client, the trial court actually said, the gang you were convicted of, does it have guns? And then engaged in cross-examination using leading questions from Mr. Carter.
And your answer for not objecting to this during the course of the trial is the same as Ms. Crump?
Yes, sir. I would also point out to the court with regard to a separate argument, when I did object in closing to the Assistant United States Attorney stating that his witnesses basically did not have criminal records, the court, I believe this is a direct quote, said to me, "I'm tired of these conferences, I'm disgusted with this, now get back there and let's get going." That was, I would suggest to the court, the general tone throughout the trial. The trial did take longer and had some delays that were unexpected, but there was considerable, I would just say that that statement captures the tone of the trial court in the case.
I'm just thinking about a case like this, and you know, it's been a long time since I tried cases, and I can very well understand your position, but if you continually object, the trial judge is asking these questions, it becomes apparent to everybody in the courtroom something is happening here that ought not be happening. And when it comes on appeal, it looks very stark when it comes up here and you got this trial judge continually asking questions that deal with the credibility of witnesses. And I guess I'm having some odds at a counsel who sits at the table and says nothing because you think the jury is going to be intimidated, but what he's asking is going to convince the jury.
Well,
from your perspective.
From
words, what you got to lose?
If you let the judge keep asking these questions, you're going to lose this case, it looks like to me, but you don't say anything.
Well, it was a decision made during the trial not to object to the judge asking the questions. Oftentimes, the jury sees that as interference and does
not. You did it on purpose not to object. It wasn't like you just, you made a strategic decision not to object, but even after it was over, you didn't say, "Your Honor, I guess you moved for a mistrial based on this basis."
Yes, sir.
And of course, he denied that. But
well, I would also point out that, I would point out the quote
even
I just
read. If it's plain error, is it still subject to harmless error review?
I guess obviously plain
error. We still could look at this and say, well, there's evidence overwhelming otherwise it was introduced that would uphold this verdict.
Yes, sir. My understanding of the case law is that even if it's plain error, the court could apply that analysis to it, but would suggest in this particular case, with the case coming down to a pure credibility contest between the two sides, obviously, and the judge basically weighing in on that credibility contest, that this particular case, it is obviously not harmless error. With regard to the closing, which I briefly referenced before, the Assistant U.S. Attorney stated that his witnesses had minimal or no criminal history and would assert that that in and of itself, in a credibility case such as this, was particularly harmful and is not harmless error, and the judge did allow that.
And this whole harmless error business review goes not to the charges, because it's clear they both admit to possessing it, the felons, all of those elements. It's this justification defense.
Yes, sir. I understood
this
that
all
question.
All about a justification defense.
Yes, sir, it is. Whether
the question, without that, they're guilty.
Yes, sir. They both testified that they did possess
the
weapon.
Whether there was this evidence of the justification defense.
Whether
that would make this not harmless error.
Yes, sir. This is an unusual case in that what we're arguing about is whether the judge prejudiced the juror with regard to the justification defense, not whether they actually possessed the weapons in the first place.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Watson. Yeah. Mr. Hatch. May it please the court, Ben Hatch on behalf of the United States.
Your Honors, I'd like to go right to Judge Wynn's questions, and particularly about the failure to object. And the law appreciates any trial attorney, government or defense, is in an awkward position if the judge, obviously coming from a position of authority, is asking questions. And that's why Rule 614, which authorizes the judge to ask questions of witnesses, and 614C authorizes either party to either object contemporaneously or to object at the next available time outside the presence of the jury.
That rule is pretty clear, and that's a good rule. I've seen that used a lot of times for clarification, and where you need something explained is kind of confusing. You got something a little different here in this case here, at least in terms of the number of cases. Now, I suppose you try a lot of cases.
I do my best.
Is this usual for a trial judge? I mean, this record is replete with a lot of, it's almost like he didn't need you guys there. Is it usual for what was going on here?
I would say it's not unusual for some of the judges we have down in Norfolk. I think as the law in the various cases, and I think there's no issue really about the law here and what the parameters are, but it appreciates that with the common objective of a fair and just trial, there's going to be different styles to get there. And I've in the Eastern District, I've worked in our Alexandria, Richmond, and now I'm in a Norfolk office, so I've covered all the judges at one point or another. And to me, it's not kind of out of the bell curve, if you will.
It's good if it's a bench trial, but when you have a jury up and you got a judge up here with a robe on and asking questions, and one of the things the record can't reflect is the voice inflection, the look, or the things, the way in which the judge, that's the danger that the cases seem to indicate that the problem is on cases like this, is that you don't get in. You got counsel here. Let them try their case, and if there's something genuinely that needs some further, because it's really confusing what the guy's trying to say, and you're trying to help him get out his, that's one thing, but to ask pointed questions and then to challenge directly, there's a few times he actually challenged directly whether he's telling the truth. And here, the witnesses, doesn't that cross it a little bit?
Well, if I try to address everything Your Honor said and
address the last point.
Okay, I'll start with the last point. I take it Your Honor's referring to a couple of the questions that were the court directed to the defendants, Eklund and Carter, at points. And the thing I'd say about those, and I know as members of this panel are familiar, there's been the Gary's decision and some other decisions that are out there, particular to this court. And the thing I'd say about those questions is, unlike some of the ones that I think the court was troubled with in Gary's, is they began, I think if you look at almost every one of those exchanges, they began as a non-leading question, attempting, the one that was objected to, the questioning of Mr. Eklund, began essentially as a summary of what he'd said. And what I'd say, Judge Wynn, in this case is there was a lot of difficult witnesses, and I think if I've read this record backwards and front, the court dished out questions to almost every witness, government or defense, and the court gave guidance to every attorney, government and defense. So I think there was a fairly even hand, but these witnesses, one of the government's witnesses had to be arrested the first day of trial. Several of the defense witnesses, I think there was challenges of maintaining a coherent and focused direct. And the court even gave Mr. Watson the authority to lead one of the witnesses, so one of the defense witnesses. So what I would say as to Mr. Eklund was the court was getting in there trying to summarize at the beginning of that exchange the series of events that he had described, which was a bit chaotic as anyone would expect in a gunfight. And it was only when Mr. Eklund made this claim in response to a summary question that the man he was shooting at
from the judge,
but again, the intro question, which is my focus to begin with, Your Honor, is this is your testimony, and that would all have made sense from the defendant's standpoint. That is,
were these questions, was it you had a witness on the stand and you have the prosecution ask questions or whoever is doing the direct, whether it's the defendant or prosecution, and then you have the cross, you have redirect or recross or whatever, and then the judge then asked questions, or did he just, from the transcript, it looked like he just jumped in the middle of it, and you might have had those questions on your pad over there. You might want to ask those questions, but he sort of took over and asked, helped you out there, asking these questions. You were going to ask those questions anyway, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't trying it, Your Honor.
Well, tell me, well, you would think that the person trying it would probably.
Right, I think that these were, I mean, that's another point I'd make. I think that these were legitimate questions about facts of the case.
Ask those questions or give them a chance to try the case, then get in and try it for them.
Well, the best I can say to that, Your Honor, I mean, the judge picked his moments. He's a very experienced trial judge. And there were times.
What brings to mind? This is deliberate. That's exactly right. He knows what he's doing. He knows what this is. He's done trials many times, and this is not an inquisition where you just everybody just asks questions indiscriminately. That's not the purpose of a jury trial. And I'm troubled by that aspect of it. But one way or the other on it. But it just troubles me when I see a case like this. Well, the judges, I mean, it's a very pointed question. That's about whether you're in a gang, and does this gang have guns? And where does that come from?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I mean, again, not to speak for the judge, but my reading of the record where that question would have come from is that Mr. Carter had claimed he didn't know what type of firearm he had picked up that he observed in the hallway of the building.
The judge didn't believe me, so the judge decided I'm gonna ask some questions and flesh out, you know, for the jury and for myself that you can't be right on this. So he's proven he's lying, or at least giving some indication of it, right?
Well, I think the gentleman had said, and I mean, I'd submit to the court, I've done several cases with AK-47s. They are one of the most distinct weapons that there is, most widely known. And so when the gentleman testified that he had no idea what this weapon was, and he didn't deal in weapons, was his testimony. And I think the question went to that, to say, you know, do you know about weapons? I don't dispute it was going to ask about the facts of the case. I mean, it was relevant to what he had testified about. And it was limited in nature, Your Honor. And again, it wasn't objected to. And so I think that this court's decision say, again, different styles, the ultimate benchmark is, does it deprive them of a fair trial? And particularly when it's plain error, is there other evidence to support the verdict? I'd submit there is.
Is there a distinction in our analysis of the plain error? Could we find plain error and go on to find that nonetheless it was harmless?
Well, the under the plain error analysis, which
yes,
we'd offer, it has to have been error. It has to have been plain. That is obvious to the judge. And then when we go on, that it's not kind of in the same words as harmlessness, but the third prong, if you've shown those, is whether it affected their substantial rights, and that inquiry here is really, they bear the burden under plain error of that. Under harmless error, usually the government would bear the burden of showing that it didn't, but under plain error, they bear the burden.
Well, my question, I just need a clarification on that from your perspective. So if we found all three, including the third one, does there still exist that opportunity, or at least the concession, or was the other evidence that was presented so overwhelming that this is harmless?
Yes, Your Honor, yes. That I think that consideration can factor both into the third element of plain error or into the fourth. That is, whether it affected the fairness, integrity of the proceedings. And Your Honors, again, because I didn't try this case, I like to think I'm very prepared on all my cases, but I really went through this record.
You did try it. The previous case, the counsel had tried it. It helps a lot when you say you know, that you know what happened below.
No, I know you're.
Let me ask one question on the sentencing. The judge enhanced the sentence based upon the credibility factors, and they said that he perjured himself or he was lying on the stand. And what is not really argued, but I'm trying to understand, that seemed to be something wrong with that. If the basis for the credibility comes from his questions, in other words, he's the one. He didn't believe him during the trial. You can tell it from his statements. And then he punishes them based on questions he's asked.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the basis. I think Mr. Watson, through his direct, elicited. Because remember, if Mr. Carter, the challenge of this defense for them is that you can't possess that gun. I mean, honestly, I don't even think this fits, even under their version, within a justification defense, but we didn't oppose the instruction, let them make their argument, it was given. But the challenge is you can't possess that gun 1 second before the exigency arises. Which is a difficult challenge. And obviously we didn't find his testimony credible. The way I think he went about that is to say, I just observe an AK-47 by happenstance before this. And I believe that that was his story, whether Judge Dumas brought out a particular part of that or not. That was his story. It had to be.
Let me make sure I understand. You were saying because he said he hadn't, he didn't possess or didn't, had just observed before, that that's problematic. If he admits it, that he's, I mean, isn't that kind of an incrimination thing? I mean, he's a felon,
right,
and you're trying to get him to say, I possessed the gun before, and you...
No, Your Honor, I'm suggesting that's why he had to craft his testimony the way he did, because if he's walking along with this gun, I mean, let's be honest, there's an AK-47 was not sitting on the floor of that housing area. I mean, I just think that's patently clear. So his challenge, of course, is if I'm walking along or I know and I have constructive possession of the gun before this alleged altercation occurs, I'm guilty of being a felon in possession because I have no justification.
That's why I keep asking about this harmless error, because it just seems to me that kind of flows what you just said. I mean, it's kind of hard to say there's going to be a justification because all of you, the charges possess it. It did not appear out of thin air. So, I mean, that's why I'm getting at that harmless error.
I think it is harmless, Your Honor. I mean, that is another argument that we have. Our witnesses established that they brought out this gun, obviously had it in advance, the inference from the whole circumstance. So there's no harm to it. The other part of justification, to go to your court's harmlessness point, is the third prong of justification is, of course, I have to avail myself of any other legal alternative to what I could do. And the obvious one in this case was just walk away, okay? You're in a public place. They were able to run away right after this, back away from this situation. So you could just walk away. And so I respectfully disagree with Mr. Watson that it's a pure credibility determination. I think the jury could have looked at this and said, you know, there's a lot of testimony, but at the end of the day, it didn't justify you bringing an AK-47 out there and firing off near 20 rounds in a crowded housing area. And
did the court question the government witnesses like this?
It did, Your Honor, at various points. And, you know, the government witnesses, again, one of the individuals had to be arrested, Your Honor. Another one, Ms. Falcone, I would say was a significant divergence in areas from her grand jury testimony. So, but they were obviously the government witnesses, but the court went in and questioned them at various points, even utilizing grand jury testimony to the aid of the defense counsel. And this was an area, again, I say it went both ways. Both sides in the court's view, and I think it was correct under the law of evidence, both sides exhibited some difficulties at time laying the proper foundation and then proceeding to impeach with grand jury testimony. But the court never stood in the way of proper impeachment. It said that repeatedly in the record. You've just got to do it the right way. You lay the foundation, the current inconsistent statement, and then you ask if on a previous day they made an inconsistent statement. And that's exactly right under the rules of evidence. It was just that it became a habitual problem that it was not being accomplished correctly. And I think that that's why the judge ruled. And if I could just say, Ms. Crump, in response to the court's questions, said that at these various sidebars they were making objections, and I would respectfully disagree with that. Going through this whole record, they raise issues with almost everything, so you got to look at the whole thing. The sidebars were for particular points about whether it be impeachment by a prior inconsistent statement, whether it be leading questions. They weren't about this general issue of the court asking questions. That was only, and in fact, Judge Dumas was the one who prompted Ms. Crump even on that occasion to say, are you objecting? And she said yes. So these sidebars were for discrete evidentiary issues, and they really didn't go to the court's questioning. And the final thing I'd say about the court's questioning is, Judge Wynn, you made the point that the court would interject at various times, whether it be during direct or cross, but the court always would tender the witness to both parties after it had asked questions and say, have I raised any issues for either party? And if it had, and there were a few times, each side was given an opportunity to ask follow-up questions. And so, I mean, what more opportunity can you have? Have I raised any issues? If you're going to object, and you know, the law doesn't let you just sit there and say nothing and then try to undo it all later. Your Honors, I would also like to make the point, one of the issues of trial management that Ms. Crump raised was that they weren't allowed to question Mr. Wallace, obviously an important witness. But what the judge is doing was just managing the trial. The government was putting on affirmative evidence as to the offense, felon in possession. The defense was entirely able to put on its own case at the appropriate time as to justification. But that comes in the defense case. And that's what Judge Dumas said. He specifically said with Mr. Wallace, you can call him in your case if you want to talk about the justification defense. The time here is for cross-examination of Mr. Wallace as to what he just testified about. So the court was just ordering the order of witnesses. And even in Ms. Crump's brief, she says the questioning went to the justification defense, not to questioning or impeaching the testimony on direct. Mr. Watson said that Mr. Roundtree, in his closing, made this reference to Ms. Falcone not having a criminal history or not having any criminal convictions, and that he wasn't allowed to object. Your Honors, I again respectfully, what the joint appendix shows is Mr. Watson, after Mr. Roundtree was done, came up and said, you know, I do object to that testimony. Judge Dumas said, well, you didn't object in a timely fashion. You need to object when it happens. And I think that that's significant. This is different from court questioning where you're allowed to object later. We make no dispute. It turned out that wasn't in the record. We made no dispute of that in our brief. It was an unintentional reference by Mr. Roundtree in a long closing. He didn't come back to it. If Mr. Watson had objected in a timely manner, I'm quite certain Mr. Roundtree would have said, I misspoke on that. There's no evidence of that. I mean, that's why you need timely objections, so you can correct it at the time. And the court even said to Mr. Watson, well, you can correct it in your closing, because this wasn't in rebuttal. It wasn't the last thing the jury heard. It was in Mr. Roundtree's initial close. So there was every opportunity to address it. They chose not to, and I think that reflects that it wasn't a significant issue. Of the three eyewitnesses the government had, Ms. Falcone was obviously the least significant. Ms. Bonds and Mr. Wallace were much more significant. And the last thing, Judge Wynn, on this point of the judge's questioning, when I picked up the joint appendix in this case, Mr. Roundtree, by the way, got called up to active duty, and that's why he can't be here today. So that's unfortunate. But when I went through it, it is unfortunate that apparently the entire jury instructions weren't included in the joint appendix, because I think they really, if there's any concern, they ought to alleviate it. The court multiple times instructed the jury, in fact, by my count, and I have the full set. I ordered the full transcript. I can hand it to the court today, or if the court wants, we could file a supplemental joint appendix. But the court twice said, do not take any of the court's comments as reflecting opinions. The court's just trying to clarify the standard types of instructions this court's familiar with. That was at pages 128 and 133. Of the full transcript of those instructions. Also made similar instructions about not assuming any admonishment of counsel reflected any views of the court. Mostly that was done at sidebar in any event. And then also respectfully, I know it hasn't come up, but the claims made by the defense that reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, and burden of proof instructions weren't given, and I don't know if there was just some unclarity, but those are all in those instructions. The court instructs on reasonable doubt. The government bears the burden proof beyond a reasonable doubt, must prove all these elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendants are... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Have the presumption of
innocence. Yes, Your Honor, it does. The presumption of innocence. Yeah, that's on page 134 of the full set. And if Your Honor's like, I have copies for everyone, I can hand them up. But that's on page 134. The defendants are presumed innocent. They begin the trial with no evidence against them. And these are all standard type instructions. So I don't know if that was a product of parts being removed or what the issue is. But if the court had any interest in that issue, I will submit the full instructions, and I submit they would alleviate that issue. Your Honor, just in closing, if there's no more issues, this was a very serious offense. These two gentlemen were extremely dangerous, multiple-time convicts, engaged in extremely violent behavior. I think it was a trial that presented issues for the judge to manage with witnesses. And, you know, the court said before, no trial is perfect, but the ultimate benchmark is, was this a fair and just trial? And I'd submit that at the end of the day, it was. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hatch. Ms. Crump.
Thank you. If I could just address Judge Hamilton's question. On page 288, in regards to what time, one instance in which the judge instructed the witness not to answer, I was questioning Mr. Wallace about any contact he had with Daquana, or if he recall him being out there when the confrontation occurred. And the court basically said, don't answer the question. And there were other instances in which that happened with witnesses.
Did he say why he told him not to answer the question?
He just said, we went over this, Ms. Crump, don't answer the question. But as I've indicated in the brief, the whole issue about Daquan and his interaction with Mr. Wallace to stop him from, you know, shooting at Mr. Eklund was not allowed by the court. And we have pointed out in our brief that it was day two of the trial that most of the testimony occurred except for the defendant's testimony. And the defense didn't start until four. So as part of cross-examination, we would be entitled to be able to impeach the witness. We indicated to the court in a sidebar, if Mr. Wallace denied it, that's fine, but if we have witnesses to say otherwise, it goes to his credibility. But the court would not allow questions about the conflict that started with Ms. Falcon, that continued with Ms. Bonds, as well as Mr. Wallace, which really went specifically to the justification defense. And it's our position that we didn't have to wait until we started our case to introduce that evidence. We would submit to the court that, but for the judge's interference, the jury would have had evidence to support the justification defense, which we believe we were hampered in presented, and would have found my client, Mr. Eklund, not guilty.
Ms. Crump, was it you or your co-counsel that alleged the judge did not charge on reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, and burden of proof?
It was my allegation, Your Honor.
Do you stand by that?
I do stand by that, and I did note in my reply brief that it was the government that asked to take it out. And it wasn't until after...
Your position is the judge did not charge the presumption of innocence to the jury?
He did not. He made reference to reasonable doubt, but that instruction was taken out. And I would just submit to the court that when you're looking at the reasonable doubt presumption, one of the last things that's mentioned is if the jury views the evidence to permit two conclusions, one of innocence and one of guilt, they have to adopt innocence. That's a crucial instruction. So the mere mention that the government has the burden of proof around a reasonable doubt is not enough. And the court instructed that the burden shifted to the defense, which is not true. We have to prove an affirmative defense, but the ultimate burden always lies with the Commonwealth. And for that reason, we would ask that the court vacate the sentence and remand it back to be tried before a different judge.
I want to ask one question, a couple of questions on this justification defense you presented. Your client is in this altercation, and the other person points a gun at your client.
Yes, sir.
And then your client then, what's the time, what happens then? What's the sequence?
What happened was once Mr. Wallace approached my client, his friend, Daquan, who was out there, which is corroborated by Ms. Bonds, who doesn't know him, says he has a gun. There is some communication briefly. Mr. Wallace points the gun at my client. Daquan immediately...
Where is he standing when he points the gun at him?
He's right in front of him.
So the two of them right there?
It's Mr. Wallace in front of my client.
Pointing a gun at your client.
Pointing a gun at my client.
And your client reacts by...
Immediately, he doesn't do anything because his friend Daquan intervenes, and he's getting into a tussle with Mr. Wallace to get the gun. My client then backs up. He starts backing up. And as he's backing up, Mr. Wallace and Mr. Daquan are fighting over the gun, and he's watching this.
So at that time, is your client in a position to leave?
No, he's not, Your Honor. Our position is he was still under an imminent threat because this guy was...
But he's fighting with the other guy.
He's fighting with the guy,
so his focus is on the guy he's fighting with. I'm wondering, is he out in an open field, or is he around buildings?
There is in a parking lot in a very, you know, small area, probably this area in the courtroom. And so my client is still under an imminent threat because the guy is wielding a gun. At any point in time, he could shoot him. So he's backing up to get out of the harm's way, but he can't.
How does that kill the threat if he gets a gun? Or if he even seeks to get a gun? How is that going to kill the threat? I'm trying to figure out how that works.
His attempt to kill the threat was to shoot in the air in hopes that the other guy would run away. But he didn't. He immediately started firing at my client.
But the other guy could run away, and you just told me your client couldn't run away because that wouldn't kill the threat. So the other guy wouldn't run away either for the same basis.
The other guy did run away once my client shot in the air. But I would submit to the court that my client was under a threat throughout. He's watching this guy, Wallace, pointing a gun trying to shoot at him and his friend trying to stop him. So the imminent threat is still there because at any time, Mr. Wallace could shoot my client. My client's backing up. Unbeknownst to him, Mr. Carter gives him a gun. There are other people out there. At which time, my client, trying to defray the situation, shoots in the air. Daquan runs away. He breaks apart from Mr. Wallace.
One last question on this. When your client approaches Mr. Wallace, does he already have the information that Mr. Wallace may have a gun?
No. At the time Mr. Wallace approached my client, it was Mr. Wallace, Ms. Bonds, and Ms. Falcon. They all approached him because they were fussing about him touching Ms. Falcon. At the time, immediately, he didn't see it, but his friend alerted him he has a gun.
And immediately, that point, what did he do?
It all happened so quickly. The next thing that happens is there is some comment made about don't touch my cousin.
Heard he had a gun, what did he do? Did he leave, or did he say,
he
okay?
He couldn't leave, because the guy immediately pulled the gun out. Because there was
a comment. You told me there were comments.
He said something to him about don't touch my cousin. The guy sees a gun, and immediately as he sees the gun, taking it out.
You're confusing me a little bit. He says something about don't touch my cousin. Your client says that.
No. Mr. Wallace says that to my client. Don't touch my cousin, Tierra. Okay. And so Mr. Daquan sees the gun, and as they're communicating, he's reaching, pulling it out, and immediately it appears that Mr. Daquan saw the gun right before Wallace pulled it out and pointed it at Eklund. And so Eklund's backing up, Daquan's fighting with Mr. Wallace, and then Mr. Carter runs up, he runs up with the gun. My client grabs it, shoots it in the air, hoping that it would just break it up. It doesn't. Daquan runs, and immediately Wallace starts shooting at my client. So we would submit to the court he was under a constant imminent threat of harm, and that he did not do anything to place himself in that situation.
Ms. Crump, in your brief, do you raise a question about the district court not charging the presumption of innocence?
At the time, I did not realize that instruction had been taken out, and I will submit to the court that was error on my part, but the court gave us his drafted instructions immediately before closing arguments. We didn't have an opportunity to go through what the court had changed.
Not in your brief.
It is in my brief. I did raise the issue that the instruction was removed.
Well, I don't have your brief. Would you refer me to the page of that?
If you would look in my reply brief on page 3, I indicate that.
Page what?
Page 3 on the reply brief. Mm-hmm. I indicated that in response to the government's statement that the instructions were given, I indicate, without belaboring the point, it is clear from the record that no jury instructions were given to the jury on these areas of law. Noted within the appendix, the court removed these instructions at the government's suggestion, which is at Joint Appendix 515, and the court thereafter shifted the burden of proof to the defendants during the instruction phase, and the references to that is contained within Joint Appendix 552 to 555. It is clear that these instructions, as detailed within the government and defense instruction package, were not given.
Yeah, the first sentence says the government's brief incorrectly states certain facts, such as whether the court instructed the jury on reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, and burden of proof. Was that raised in your initial brief, that issue?
I believe I did make reference to the fact that the jury did not get instructions on the reasonable doubt, burden of proof, and that was one of the issues pertaining to what substantial rights were affected by the judge's actions. If I could just have a second.
Here it is. I'm looking at page 21 of your brief.
Okay. Thank you.
The second sentence says the court further emphasized and shifted the burden to the defense, unbeknownst to the defense at the time, the reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, and burden of proof instructions were removed, although they were in the defense and government instructions. So I can tell you, we're going to need the entire charge.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Grubb. Mr. Watson.
First, I'd point out on pages 528 and 529 of the joint appendix relating to the closing argument of the government. After the comments about Ms. Bonds, Ms. Falcon, and Mr. Wallace, who were the three government witnesses, having minimal or no criminal history, after that or those comments were made, the Assistant United States Attorney only made four or five more sentences before he sat down. I actually indicated to the judge that I was reluctant to interrupt closing, especially when he was ending, but would just suggest that was not an untimely objection of requesting a sidebar four or five sentences after those comments were made in closing. And the court actually said, well, actually I quoted it earlier, but the court then told me I could go ahead and argue to the contrary. And I pointed out, Judge, that was something that's inadmissible. I can't argue to the contrary of something that's been introduced to the jury. That is, these three witnesses have minimal or no criminal history. I don't have any evidence one way or the other, because of course no evidence could have been given. It would have been objected to if it had been attempted to be given during the course of the trial. So at that point, all I could do is then argue to the jury, but I can't argue that they do not or do have criminal histories, because obviously I don't know one way or the other. And at that point, the jury is sitting there believing that they, well, I guess not that they don't have criminal histories, because the question was an or. They have minimal or no criminal history. But at that point in the trial, there's simply nothing that could be done to fix that, other than, of course, the judge giving an instruction to the jury to disregard that argument and instructing the jury that they had no evidence in front of them one way or the other as to the criminal histories.
Your defense in this case was the justification defense?
Yes, sir.
And it was your client that gave the gun? Is that disputed?
No, sir, that was not disputed. Both Mr. Carter and Ms.
In fact, was possessing at the time he gave it. When did the justification defense arise in that context for the possession charge?
The testimony at trial was that Mr. Eklund and Mr. Wallace were in the courtyard, and that Mr. Carter, my client, was nearby but within plain view of the entire situation, and that he had been involved in the situation that originally arose between Ms. Falcon and Mr. Eklund, and the series of people that Ms. Falcon had brought back to the apartment complex to deal with Mr. Eklund. And then finally, she brought Mr. Wallace back, and that my client was in clear view of what was transpiring between Mr. Wallace and Mr. Eklund. That is, Mr. Wallace getting out of his car with a handgun and pointing it at Mr. Eklund. And at that point, and only at that point, did he testify and the other defense witnesses testified that he picked up the AK-47 and handed it to Mr. Eklund so that Mr. Eklund could defend himself.
And his justification defense, was he in danger?
His justification defense was dependent on assisting Mr. Eklund, who was in danger.
And Mr. Eklund, was that a relative or a son or a child? Or?
I do not believe they are related, but they are very close friends.
You ever seen a case like that, one on a justification defense, where someone is standing, picks up a gun, and he gets the justification defense for, I guess, a friend or somebody who's in an argument or looks like they're about to get in an argument?
On a
charge of possession?
I would have to admit that he is a half step removed from Mr. Eklund as far as the
I'm just trying to see, I'm talking about your defense. Have you ever seen that won in any court? I mean, that doesn't sound like to me you can get that defense for that.
I would concede that it is more difficult. It's certainly a more difficult case than Mr. Eklund had, but with Mr. Carter.
The theory is somebody else is in imminent danger or in possible danger because he perceives this man has a gun and his friend or whomever standing doesn't, and he reaches on the ground. These guns are just laying on the ground in this neighborhood. It's quite a neighborhood. You just have an AK-47 laying on the ground?
That was the testimony at trial. Yes, sir. That he came upon the gun, that he had not possessed it previous to Mr. Wallace getting out of his car and pointing his gun at Mr. Eklund. And I would just point out that the only witness that the government had in opposition to what Mr. Eklund, Mr. Carter, and the other defense witnesses said was Mr. Wallace. Ms. Bonds and Ms. Falcon actually did not testify as to they certainly didn't testify as to Mr. Eklund having a weapon first. It was only Mr. Wallace who testified to that.
But there's no dispute about that evidence you gave there, at least that statement that he just reached down on a gun, picked up a gun. He wasn't in danger himself. He perceived someone else may be in danger, picked up a gun, for which the charge against him then arises because he is a felon possessing the gun, hands it someone. That evidence is not in dispute. There's no credibility issue on that, is it?
I would just say that he was in the courtyard with somebody getting out of his car pointing a gun at Mr. Eklund.
He was not perceived to be in danger.
Well, only to the extent of somebody in the general area pulling out a gun and starting pointing it in the general direction of Mr. Eklund. At that point, the testimony was that Mr. Carter and Mr. Eklund were not standing side by side, but they were not too far away from each other. So he
How far?
It's hard for me to state. I'm not sure if anybody stated exactly the number of feet at trial. I'm sure it's in the record somewhere, but I would.
So you have a defense of others' defense.
Exactly. Yes, sir. He was in the general area when the gun was pulled. I would say maybe 10 or 15 feet. It might have been a little bit further. I don't want to misstate the record. He was assisting Mr. Eklund in addition to that.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Just to expedite things, Mr. Hatch, you've got a copy of the complete jury charge.
And yes, sir.
Is there any objection from the defendants to him submitting that, or do you need an opportunity to review it and respond?
If we could review it.
All right, if you would just communicate with Mr. Hatch and let us know the results, but we do need copies of an accurate, complete charge in this case. Ms. Crump, Mr. Watson, I appreciate your representing clients in this case. I know you're appointed, and we do appreciate your undertaking this representation. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet counsel.
stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.